We are talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. A little bit slower of a week because of the holiday, but apparently the rest of the world didn't get the news on that. So
we'll get to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but Maria had been talking a lot about the budget over the last several weeks, and they finally had a vote on it the beginning of the week.
Yeah, the City Council voted the budget out of committee on Monday with no major changes. And then in the afternoon on Monday, they voted to 8-1 with Sawant, the dissident no vote, to approve the budget. Now it's headed to Mayor Durkan. It's possible she might veto the budget because of cuts to the Seattle Police Department of about $10 million. But the police department is still going to get an increase in funding this year over 2021. So I don't think that the cuts are big enough for her to hold up the entire budget. And I think a veto is futile since the majority of the city council passed it. They're just going to, a huge majority of the city council, they're just gonna approve it over the mayor's veto anyway. So it's headed to Durkan, and then we'll see. She'll probably sign it in or send it back unsigned as a protest.
Which she's done numerous times before.
Which she's done many times. Yeah, she did that with the jumpstart payroll tax, for example, and then turned around and tried to use the jumpstart payroll tax funds to help balance the budget. So
yeah, we're just we've only basically got about a month left of Mayor Durkan.
That's true. But then, of course, we start Mayor Harrell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we may look at the transition team for Bruce Harrell in a future week, but it looks like a lot of the same people from the Durkan administration. So I expect there to be a lot of continuity when Harrell starts office.
And a lot of continuity in policies, too.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not necessarily good news for anyone. Mm-hmm. Except the downtown big businesses. All right. Well, let's move on. We are a week away from the next election taking place.
A little over a week. It's December 7th, so 10 days from today, Saturday. Mm-hmm. And people in District 3 have already gotten their ballots. That's to yes or no on whether you want to recall council member Sawant. And, you know, since we go over ballots for general elections and primaries, it seems only reasonable that we do the same for the recall. You know, the allegations against Chama, which are the ostensible reason for wanting to recall her, are that she organized a rally last year outside Mayor Durkan's house, which she very much did not organize. She spoke at it, but she did not organize it. And that she brought a bunch of BLM marchers into City Hall in violation of pandemic protocols, which is true. I haven't heard anything that there was any harm actually done from that. Nobody caught COVID, for example, as a result of people wearing masks inside City Hall. But those were the reasons that were upheld by the state courts to put this recall measure on the ballot. If you look at who is supporting the recall effort, it's a lot of developers, a lot of real estate people, and a lot of people who have historically opposed Sawant. And I think they're banking that with a special election and with only Sawant on the ballot as the yes or no, as opposed to her running against a flawed candidate, which the two times she's been reelected, they've very much been flawed candidates, and the original race in which she was elected was a flawed candidate too, those being Richard Conlon, Pamela Banks, and Egan O'Ryan. So, you know, without that distraction, the question is, do you like Sawant or not? And there is no question that she has the most name familiarity of any council member by far. And a lot of that is due to local media. A lot of that local media has been gunning for her for nearly a decade now. They were initially very dismissive of her, and they're still dismissive of her. The knock on her is that she doesn't collaborate with council members, which is simply not true. That she's not effective and doesn't get anything done, which is also not true. She's gotten a lot done over the years. And, you know, these are a lot of the same people that are backing the recall effort. There's also the question of precedent. There has never been a successful recall election in Seattle. And, you know, if you can get a recall measure on the ballot and get it passed just because you don't like a particular candidate's policies, that strikes me as a very bad precedent. That's not how the law for recalls is actually written. It's written that the person has to do something, you know, malfeasance in office, basically. And, you know, there have been a lot of accusations for Sawant over the years. None of them have really stuck. She's gotten some minor fines from the Ethics and Election Commission, but, you know, nothing more serious than I think other council members have run into as well. And, you know, the question really is, do you want to open up District 3 for for the council to appoint a temporary successor and then have a special election to fill out the remaining 2 years of Sawant's term? Or do you want her to keep her on the council? I think she's had a very positive effect on city council. It has moved the Overton window, as the political scientists say, in that, you know, council has discussed and taken seriously ideas that it probably never would have without Sawant there. You know, I'm not sure that I would want 9 Sawants on city council, but yeah. 1 out of 9 is I think very helpful.
Yeah. At the top of the list of what Chama Sawant has gotten done is the $15 an hour minimum wage for Seattle, something that Bruce Harrell tried to take credit for in this past election. And something that he did not actually work on when he was on council. It was Sawant who proposed it. And then Teresa Mosqueda stepped in, and a couple of the other council members like Lorena Gonzalez stepped in and helped work on that with her to try to get a compromise. And that's probably the leading accomplishment for her, but she's done many other things for renters in particular, and has also worked with Mosqueda to try to make the city a better place for workers in general. So things like paid family leave and
she's gotten a lot of amendments into the city budget, that reflect her priorities as well.
Yeah.
That's something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but she's been very effective in that.
Particularly on behalf of youth, on lesbian, gays, et cetera, for renters, for working people. She's been a great resource on the city council. And when you hear complaints that she doesn't listen to her constituents, those tend to come from big businesses in her district or from the Downtown Seattle Association. She's not, her office doesn't have an open door to big business lobbyists. She does, on the other hand, listen to labor unions and to working people. And so that's, I think, the main reason why, real estate lobby wants her off the council.
Yeah, and also I would say immigrants. She's been a champion
for them as well.
Mm-hmm. In terms of getting this, having the city getting resources to immigrant communities,
mm-hmm.
Which really wasn't happening before she got on council. So.
Yeah, it was really her and Gonzalez who have been kind of championing immigrant communities on the city council. And, so, you know, she's not a lone wolf out there proposing these ideas. She does work with other city council members. She does propose ideas that other city council members maybe aren't, brave enough to, you know, she proposes the full on measure. Let's do this. And, the other council members say, okay, let's talk about that. How can we get there? And yeah, that gets the ball rolling.
Yep. And as I say, that's moving the window of what's possible, mm-hmm. And what the priorities are for the council as a whole and the city as a whole. You know, she's had an enormous impact, for one council member. But again, that's precisely the reason why she's facing this recall effort. So if you live in, District 3, it's the same thing we went through earlier this month for the general election. Use the Dropbox if you can, especially with holiday mail starting up. If you have to mail it, make sure you mail it early. The actual election is 10 days from today, December 7th, a Tuesday. So, try and get something in the mail by like the middle of this coming week if you can. Or use a Dropbox. King County Elections website has a full list of the Dropboxes. There's several in District 3. And, of course, they're scattered around the city in on the odd chance that you don't stay in District 3 all day long. So, look those up and get your ballot in.
Yeah, I remember going to one of her press conferences that she held outside an apartment complex, bringing focus to the complex and the landlord. And we got to do a tour, the press got to do a tour of a couple of the apartments there. And it was horrifying. I saw more cockroaches in this one apartment than I had seen in my entire lifetime. I mean, they were
you didn't grow up in the South.
Well, that's
well, this is not the South. So those kind of cockroaches in an apartment here in Seattle, that's bad. That is really bad.
And that is definitely speaks to the conditions of a negligent landlord for sure.
Yeah. And it was just horrifying. I mean, and just the complete disrepair of the place, and that the person living there had clearly made numerous efforts to try and make it habitable, and that simply you couldn't do it with that particular landlord. So. Mm-hmm. All right.
That's uplifting.
Yeah. So if you live in district.
Get your ballot in.
Yeah, get your ballot in. Don't ignore this as, why do I have to vote this and then forget about it. As soon as you get your ballot, mark it, send it back.
Yeah.
Or drop it
in
a Dropbox.
And you can't complain that it's a long ballot with too many people you've never heard of.
There's just one item.
Yeah.
All right. Moving
I mean, over. You could complain about that, but you'd be wrong.
All right. moving on. The appears there's not going to be an annual point in time count of homeless folks this year.
Yeah. There wasn't one last year because of COVID-19. And so the King County Regional Homelessness Authority announced this week that they don't have plans to be doing the annual point in time count this coming January for January 2022. And I have to say that for at least the last 40 years, the annual count has been done every January by the Seattle King County Coalition on the Homeless. And, and then it was transferred to All Home before being transferred to the regional authority. The 2021 count, was canceled because of COVID-19, but now the regional authority is saying that they're not going to do it this year because they say that the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development only requires counties and municipalities to do a count of the homeless every other year in odd number years. So because the 2021 count was canceled, the next count isn't due until 2023. That's what the regional authority is claiming. But then local journalist Erica Barnett of Publicola decided to ask a representative of the Housing and Urban Development Department. And that person told her that no, the HUD is expecting municipalities and counties to do the count in 2022 since they missed 2021.
Of course they are.
And she noted that HUB's website says that localities that received a waiver in 2021 are expected to do the point in time count in 2022 if they want to receive federal funding. Now, the King County Regional Homelessness Authority responded that by not doing the count, the agency could still apply for federal funds. They just lose points in the ranking when they apply, as if we need that, right?
Oh, well, that's fine then.
Right, that's fine then, right? Well,
and why would you not want more accurate data?
I know.
You know, so, because, especially because, you know, the pandemic has affected a lot of people. There's more people living on the street now, and you need to get that quantified.
Because yeah, there are a lot of people who lost their jobs during the pandemic.
If you're relying on 2019 as your most recent count, which is what it would be, mm-hmm. That's totally irrelevant data at this point. It's a different situation.
Exactly.
Now.
So, Erica Barnett.
And especially with the moratorium having been lifted on evictions.
Right. So Erica Barnett followed up with the state of Washington Department of Commerce because they manage funding to municipalities, right? They manage state contracts, and the state gives municipalities money to deal with housing and homelessness issues as well. And the State Department of Commerce said that they don't know of any other county or municipality in Washington state that has opted not to do a point in time count in 2022, except for King County. So the King County,
which is where we need it the most.
Exactly. We have the most homeless people in the state. So the regional authority pointed out that the point in time count is not considered accurate. Everyone assumes it's an undercount, which affects how much money the agency has budgeted. Well, yeah. Instead, though, they want to take the opportunity to do what they say would be a better type of count, one based on, quote unquote, existing data sources, like the Regional Homeless Management Information System, while putting together their own list by name of all the homeless people seeking services in King County. Okay, the problem with this is that this assumes that all homeless people are engaging with service providers already, when in fact
Particular service providers, not just any service providers.
Right. In fact, we know that many homeless folks avoid service providers for a number of reasons, including privacy concerns, you know, immigration status. If you're not a citizen or your visa has expired, you may not want to contact service providers if you're homeless. Some folks struggle with mental health issues. Perhaps they have legal problems, so maybe they're dodging an outstanding warrant. There may be financial reasons. They're dodging outstanding bills. Okay. Or maybe they just have a general mistrust of authority, you know, or they've had a bad experience with a service provider in the past. So there are many reasons why homeless people may dodge engaging with service providers. So that's I think a really high hurdle for putting together a by name list that the regional authority is now saying is their goal. Okay. And this attitude also ignores the decades of experience that has gone into the previous year's annual counts. Okay. There's a lot of good strategies and experience there for how to find folks who are living outdoors and don't want to be found, homeless folks. Now, I think the main problem that everyone has had with the point in time count is the timing, and that January is really a terrible time of the year to try to find folks living outdoors who are hiding, not just from the folks who might be counting them, but are hiding because of cold weather. In addition, relying on volunteers can make it more difficult in years when you have too few people on the ground to cover the entire county. So I think those are the two main issues with the point in time count. And those are issues that could be solved if you had paid folks out there, more paid folks out there counting people. And if you were doing it at a different time of year when everybody wasn't trying to get in out of the cold in some fashion.
And it's also mm-hmm. glaring that they're choosing not to do it this particular year when they just had, like a week ago, a recognition at St. James Cathedral that a record number, 221 people that we know of so far, homeless people,
died.
Had died in this last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
on the streets. So,
yeah.
You know, record
so it's
numbers there.
Yeah, so what the regional authority is saying, well, it's possible to count people who have died, but it's not possible to count people who are living outdoors, and that's crazy.
So we should kill them all, and that would solve a couple different problems.
Yeah, it's backwards, and it's bad. But it's also showing you, I think part of the reason, you look at this and you think part of the reason why Seattle wanted to shift its homelessness services to the regional authority is because we just didn't want the bad publicity, right? And so now the regional authority is like, okay, we just won't do the count, right?
And the problem goes away.
And the problem goes away, right. We come up with our own number from out of thin air, you know, to suit us.
And then you will, because of the change in methodology, you will claim that homelessness is actually decreasing. Good news.
It's actually getting better, right? And at the same time, you can make the count higher when you need money and lower when you want your stats to look good, right?
And, you know, the history of the local approach to homelessness has been full of those kind of statistical games. Literally tens of thousands of people have been permanently housed from the were living on the streets of Seattle. You may not notice that, because they've all been replaced by other people who couldn't find housing. But that's what the city has claimed with a straight face. And it's only when you look at what the definitions are for things like what is permanent housing that you realize it's a sham.
It's people cycling through temporary housing and back onto the street over and over again.
Yeah,
and at the same time they talk about the high hurdle and the difficulty of tackling completely solving the homelessness problem because of people who are chronically homeless. And then the question arises, well, what percentage of the folks who are on the street are chronically homeless? And then they're like, well, it's hard to count, you know. We don't have good numbers. We need better data, et cetera, when it's probably fairly close to 100% because of the fact that we just don't have enough affordable housing.
Well, and the Regional Homeless Authority has at least two Seattle City Council members on it. You would think that they might have some say in whether the point in time count is made this year or not.
Well, just sitting on the board doesn't mean that you direct the operations of the agency.
No, that's, I understand that, but Mark you can field questions that carry a little bit more weight than like when you or I ask the question.
Yeah, but those are two seats out of, and Mayor Durkin has a seat too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the like suburban municipalities have a lot of the seats. And they really aren't interested in dealing with the homelessness issue. They just want it to go away.
And they're not interested in funding solutions because Seattle is putting up most of the money for the regional agency, with some coming from King County Council. So, yeah, you have all these votes on the board, and you have all these folks giving input who are not necessarily interested in a solution, or who are taking more of a hands-off approach. They're saying, okay, let's give Mark Doane's a lot of leeway because he has to get the agency up and running. And they're giving a lot of leeway to people with lived experience of homelessness, but not necessarily folks who have a lot of expertise in things like funding for the agency, and things like statistics and tracking the number of homelessness. Yeah, those folks with lived experience know quite a bit about what it means to be living on the street, but do they know how to run an agency? You know, I just don't know.
But well, other people who are involved in running the agency, you know, they find folks who don't have any of that kind of experience to be easier to manipulate. And I'm sure that's part of what's going on too.
Well, it puts a lot more responsibility in their court, and they're happy with that. But I think they're also highly responsive to business concerns and to the concerns of politicians like Mayor Durkin, who would like the homelessness problem to go away and would like to see it and have a vested interest in seeing the numbers improve year to year. And the way to do that is to question
whether the actual reality on the street has improved or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you see that we've had pretty much a lost year in terms of solving the homelessness issue, with the COVID-19 pandemic and with the shift of funding from the city to the regional authority, which is still trying to get its feet and to get going, you don't want to hear the bad news, which is that the homeless population's probably grown over the past year to 2 years. So the way to hide that is to not do the count.
Well, we're a month away from, a little over a month away from a new mayor, so I'm sure he's got his team working on it as we speak.
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. Let's move on. It appears there is a new sheriff in town.
Yeah, King County Executive Dow Constantine announced this week that as of January 1st, King County will have a new interim sheriff. So instead of reappointing the current sheriff, Mitzi Johannick, Constantine will elevate her second in command, Patty Cole Tyndall, to serve as interim sheriff while he searches for a permanent candidate. In addition to serving at the sheriff's office for the past 6 years, Cole Tyndall has served as director of labor relations for King County and as an interim director for the county's Office of Law Enforcement Oversight, which oversees citizen complaints and structural issues with the sheriff's department. Last year, I should point out, voters in King County approved a charter amendment that gives the county executive the power to appoint a new sheriff and the county council the power to approve the new appointee versus having voters elect a new sheriff from the pool of candidates who live in the county. So that's a new change starting January 1st. Cole Tyndall says that she will not be applying for the permanent King County Sheriff's job or the permanent Seattle Police Chief job, which has been open since Carmen Best retired in 2020. Cole Tyndall is the first person of color to be appointed as interim sheriff for King County. Now, last fall, Cole Tyndall, the one thing that I was able to find about her is that last fall she recommended that the King County Sheriff's fire Sergeant Mike Brown for his social media posts. He's the guy that posted his All Lives Splatter post that showed a stick figure drawing of a car hitting Black Lives Matter demonstrators. And he had posted that after two demonstrators were hit by a speeding car in July of last year. Summer Taylor was one of those two activists, and she died in that incident. Sheriff Johannick reviewed the recommendations by Cole Tyndall and eventually did fire Sergeant Mike Brown. Now, Dow Constantine also announced this week new hiring and retention incentives for the King County Sheriff's Department. So the Sheriff's Department's going to be paying $15,000 for officers who transfer from another department, $7,500 for new hires, and a one-time bonus of $4,000 for every officer in the department. This comes after the Seattle City Council voted to end Mayor Durkin's emergency executive order to pay hiring incentives in the Seattle Police Department on December 31st, which is Durkin's last day in office. So just as the Seattle City Council is fighting the mayor overpaying these kinds of retention bonuses and hiring incentives, the King County executive has just announced new ones for the King County Sheriff's Department. So I thought that was also interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how Cole Tyndall does. I don't know very much about her. She's only been at the King County Sheriff's Department for about 6 years. Folks are thinking that by about the middle of next year, Dow Constantine will have a permanent candidate for the King County Council to consider for the new sheriff.
Has he said what his process will be for search?
No, he hasn't.
Is there a search committee, for example?
Yeah, he hasn't said that yet. I'm assuming he's got people who are helping him with that.
Yeah, but the question would be, if there's a search committee, you know, are there community groups represented or not?
Yeah, and I've not heard anything about that. I'm assuming that if there were community group input that he wanted, that there would be a formal search process and a official group helping him. But I've not heard an announcement of anything like that. So my guess is he's not seeking public input on that until he names his candidate. And then I'm sure both county council members and the public will have plenty of opportunity, or I hope would have plenty of opportunity, to make comments.
Yeah, or if he has a full finalist, once he gets down to a shortlist. Mm-hmm. That would be a good time also for people to be able to preview all the candidates.
Yeah.
Which has been done in the past with Seattle Police Chief.
That's how it's been done here in Seattle, and I'm sure there'll be something similar for the county.
Moving on. A lot of people throwing their hands up when the Washington State Redistricting Commission missed their deadlines.
Yeah, you know, this year all of the states in the United States are drawing up new legislative districts based on the 2020 census numbers. Every district, the idea, of course, is that every district should have a roughly equal number of people in it. District boundaries should not split up major communities like towns or cities. And as much as possible, racial and ethnic groups should not be split up. That's kind of the rough outlines of how legislative districts should be drawn. Of course, in addition, Democrats and Republicans like to make sure that the boundaries are drawn up in their favor, right? Neither party wants to lose districts that they currently control, and they both tussle over the swing districts. In addition, they don't want district boundaries to change so much that any current sitting member of their party is drawn out of their district. Okay. So the Washington State Redistricting Commission, and each state is different in who they appoint and how they draw up their maps. The Washington State Redistricting Commission is made up of five people. One person is appointed by the Democratic and Republican Party caucuses in the State House and the Senate. And there's one more person on the commission who is the chairperson, but that person does not have any power to vote. They just strictly run the commission, and they kind of mediate between the members of the commission. This year, the commissioners are Sarah Augustine is the chair. She's the executive director of the Dispute Resolution Center of Yakima and Kittitas counties. Again, her role is to lead the commission and be a nonpartisan negotiator. Okay. She does not get to vote on the final redistricting map, and she did not vote. Now, April Sims was appointed by the House Democrats. She's the Secretary Treasurer of the Washington State Labor Council. Okay. Paul Graves was appointed by the House Republicans. He's the former state representative from Maple Valley, who served a single 2-year term in the House. He sat on the Healthcare and Wellness Committee, where he worked for the interests of large pharmaceutical and healthcare corporations. He was defeated for reelection in 2018 by Democrat Lisa Callan. So he was in one of those swing districts that was expected to be contentious. The Senate Democrats appointed Brady Walkinshaw. He served 2 terms as the representative for District 43 and is now the CEO of GRIST, the environmental media organization. And then the Senate Republicans appointed Joe Fain. He served 2 terms in the state Senate, where he sat on the Transportation Committee. And while he was there, made sure that the 2015 transportation bill, the once a decade transportation bill, would focus mostly on roads, infrastructure for cars, and not include important environmental legislation like clean fuel incentives or fuel efficiency standards. He's currently the president and CEO of the Bellevue Chamber of Commerce. So those are the 4 voting members of the commission. The deadline for the commission to present a new map of legislative districts in Washington state was last Monday, November 15th. Each of the 4 partisan commissioners drew up their own map. Okay. And much of the past several weeks has been spent trying to reconcile those maps. So on Monday, the 15th, the commission met for 5 hours. Much of it was the commissioners caucusing in private. which I think is a violation of the state's Open Meetings Act. And just a few minutes before midnight, the commissioners emerged from their private caucus and took a final vote on a compromise that had not yet been drafted on paper and which had not been released to the public prior to the vote, which is very unusual. At least 3 yes votes are required to approve a redistricting map, which usually includes both a formal drawn map and a detailed written description of what the boundaries are. But because the commission lacked those materials and they had no public process, they failed to meet the deadline, even though they voted and came up with a compromise map. Okay. So when the commission, in years when the commission approves a map by the deadline, that map and description go to the state legislator to vote on. But if the commission fails to approve a map on time, as they did this year, then the commission's work product gets transferred to the Washington State Supreme Court for the court justices to review and come up with a redistricting map and a detailed description by April 30th, 2022. Mm. So that's the next step. Even though they voted and came up with a compromise map, they didn't finish their work on time. And so now the state Supreme Court will have to figure out a way to review those materials and determine if the new districting map is fair and is a good product of the commission, that meets the requirements that the commission was supposed to meet. And so they're going to have to look at that, not just the 4 different maps that were drawn up by each of the 4 members of the commission, but they're going to have to also look at the maps that were submitted by 1,300 members of the public who submitted their own, changed their own versions of maps that would change the district boundaries. So that's a lot of material to look at. And I'm guessing the Supreme Court may appoint some experts to help them out. It'll be interesting, I think, to see who those experts are and what they say about the product. Now, notably, the map that's approved by the state Supreme Court does not go to the state legislature for approval. It takes effect with just a majority vote of the state Supreme Court. Okay. Now, because our state Supreme Court is considered liberal but fair, I think there wasn't a lot of incentive for the 2 Democrats on the commission to come to an agreement with either of the 2 Republicans. In addition, because the 2020 census took so long to finish, the redistricting didn't get underway until May, after the end of the state legislative session. And this was the first year that the process had to be finished by November 15th instead of January 1st. A change that voters had approved back in 2016. So instead of having a full year to work on this, the commission only had about 6 months, so about half the time they usually have. So where it stands now is that there is a map on the commission website, or 2 maps, one for the state legislative districts and one for the federal legislative districts. But there's no description of the boundaries, just a signed document of intent to publish that material once it's been approved by the legislature, which is then followed on the website by a statement that acknowledges that the commission couldn't agree on a districting plan. So now it goes to the state Supreme Court. So you can view the compromise maps that the commission came up with, but without the detailed descriptions, you're not going to get much of an idea of what the changes are or if those districts are really fair. Okay. So I think some folks are using this as an opportunity to talk about how the state could make changes to its redistricting process. The commission could be less partisan, for one thing. If we had a citizens commission like California or Michigan, that might be fairer. It might speed up the process and remove the partisan bickering and the last minute vote that came up with a compromise map, but no description. Okay. Michigan, for example, has a 13-member commission made up of 4 voters who identify as Democrats, 4 who identify as Republicans, and 5 who are non-affiliated. California similarly has, voters, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and 4 non-affiliated. as their redistricting commission. So that's something that we may be considering, and you might see either an initiative or a bill to the state legislature to change who sits on our redistricting commission.
Yeah, so we've seen a lot of those redistricting processes in other states have been extremely gerrymandered, especially Republican-controlled states. So the process in this state is flawed, but it could be a lot worse.
Yeah, it's a little more fair, but flawed, definitely. But like I said, because we have a liberal Supreme Court, I think the two Democratic members of the commission didn't feel like they had to give much ground to come to an agreement with the Republican members of the commission. So they were kind of happy to turn it all over, I think, to the Supreme Court. I'm not sure how the state Supreme Court's going to feel about that, though, to get that big chunk of work.
Yeah. Probably are rearranging their holidays as we speak.
Yeah. Well, they have until April 30th, so we'll see. And then those new district maps will be used for any elections in November of 2022 and going forward until the next census is done 10 years from 2020, so the 2030 census.
All right. Mm-hmm. Moving on, this week's COVID pandemic news.
Yeah, well, there's quite a bit. Let me start with local. King County, Public Health Seattle and King County announced this week an enforcement plan for county businesses that are repeat offenders of the requirements that they be, asking for proof of vaccine when you go into the restaurant or bar or whatever. And that involves fines and potentially shutting down the place of business if they still refuse to do it. So that will go into effect next month, and we'll see. I expect the county will publicize when it fines or shuts down businesses for non-cooperation, and it'd be very helpful to know that information and know who's protecting their customers and who is not.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to realize that some of the smaller restaurants, particularly ones run by immigrants who don't speak English as well, may have a tougher time asking customers to show their vaccination cards. So I just want to remind folks that when you do go to eat out, just offer to show your vaccination card. Don't wait to be asked. Just kind of take it out along with your cash and say, here you go.
Yeah, and be nice about it. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, the servers who have to actually do the asking at the door get a lot of grief from people who was in the process. And it's not really fair. It's certainly not part of what shouldn't be part of their job description, but somehow it is. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, be nice about it. Come on. Play nice.
Yeah.
Nationally, we are seeing a serious spike in the number of cases in the United States now. It's gone up about 23% in the last couple of weeks. And that is almost entirely concentrated in cold weather states. So Rocky Mountain states, the upper Midwest, Michigan has been particularly hard hit, and Minnesota as well, and Wisconsin, and then New England. So this is – and we saw this also – starting about a month ago in Europe when they started to get cold weather. Cold weather, people stay inside, places are poorly ventilated, and it gets many more opportunities for the virus to spread.
Yeah, and a lot of places people have been gathering outdoors without their masks, and when they go indoors to gather, they're continuing that practice of not wearing their masks, and I think that's bad in places like Michigan, for example, which has had the highest new case rate, somewhere around 86%, I think, over the past 2 weeks. It's partly that. It's also because they have a relatively low vaccination rate of only 54% of their population. So when only one out of every two people is vaccinated, going indoors and not wearing your mask is one of the worst things you can do.
And bear in mind, this is before holiday travel. Wednesday set a new one-day record for the number of passengers who were screened by the TSA at domestic airports in the United States. If it's been in cold weather states, it's going to start going all around because people fly, they fly south for vacations and for the holidays and to see family and all the rest of that. It's likely to be grim this winter. And this is not even counting the new variant, which I wrote quite a bit about in a Facebook post that I did this morning. The World Health Organization had an emergency meeting yesterday at which they gave it the Greek letter Omicron. And this is a variant that emerged in Botswana 2 weeks ago and spread almost immediately to South Africa because South Africa's population centers of Johannesburg and Pretoria are very close to Botswana's capital city of Gaborone, which is right on the border. So there's a lot of back and forth traffic. And from South Africa, it has spread to at least 20 countries that we know of. It is almost certainly in the United States. Johannesburg serves as the travel hub for all of Southern Africa, and it has direct flights to every continent, including New York City. New York's governor of the state of New York declared a state of emergency yesterday because of this new variant. And the reason scientists are concerned about it and public health people are very concerned about it, there's several. One is that it appears to be extremely contagious, much more so even than Delta has been. It's almost entirely overtaken Delta in South Africa in only 2 weeks, so that almost all the cases now in South Africa are not Delta, they're Omicron. And, they're trying to study exactly how much more transmissible it is. They're also trying to gather data on whether it has a higher mortality, and most importantly, whether it can evade vaccines. The reason scientists are so concerned about this is that the spike protein, which is what SARS-CoV-2 uses to invade cells in the human body, has some 30 different mutations, which is about double the largest number that's been seen before. And some of these are familiar. They were in Alpha. They were in Delta. But some of these are brand new. And, the concern is that vaccines might not be able to respond or respond as effectively to this variant. Pharmaceutical companies are scrambling to try and develop a booster shot that will cover Omicron. But that's going to take some time also, obviously. And yeah. It's coming
The scientists are saying that they're studying whether the Omicron variant can infect people who are vaccinated or who've already had COVID-19. And early indications are that breakthrough infections are occurring. But like with the Delta variant, they are not as severe as they would be if you've not been vaccinated. So the vaccine appears to still be somewhat effective, and having natural antibodies from having had COVID-19 also appears to be somewhat effective. But the best is to get vaccinated and get a booster shot if you can.
And the question is, how effective are they? We don't know yet.
Yeah,
we don't know. If for unvaccinated people, and there's there's plenty of unvaccinated people in this country as well as in Europe, how severe is it? Is it more severe than the Delta variant has been in terms of mortality and hospitalizations and all those kind of metrics? We just don't know yet, and this is why the WHO was so alarmed. They named it a variant of concern yesterday and gave it the name Omicron. So you'll be hearing that a lot in the next couple of weeks. With the holiday travel coming up and having already started now, which even without this new variant would likely have led to a major spike in cases in the United States, we're already seeing that trend because of the cold weather. This is coming at the worst possible time. It's the beginning of summer vacation in the Southern Hemisphere. It's the onset of winter weather in the Northern Hemisphere. And, it's the holiday travel season for the Christian world as well. So, it's kind of a perfect storm. And this is why, for instance, the governor of New York is already declaring a state of emergency, because there's daily direct flights from Johannesburg to New York City. So it is in this country. We haven't found it yet because we've only been looking for the last day.
They've already found it in the UK and Hong Kong and various other places.
Belgium and the Netherlands, Germany.
Yeah, and I expect they'll find it at least on the East Coast here in the United States, if not other parts of the country as well.
Sure, because, you know, you fly into New York, but then you transfer because you're going to Chicago or Houston or wherever, live. Or Seattle, yeah. So, you know, again, the pandemic is not over. We're almost certainly heading into another major wave. And, you know, if you are in a public indoor space, wear a mask, regardless of your vaccination status. Get a booster if you can. If you haven't been vaccinated, for God's sakes, what are you waiting for?
Yeah.
Because this is going to be rough. It's going to be a rough winter. And it's probably going to be next springtime before we have a chance of seeing the pandemic abated. The United States in the last, month has gone from 80,000 new cases a day to 150,000 new cases a day. So it's nearly doubled. And, for context, according to Anthony Fauci, who has been pretty accurate on these things, you know, the pandemic can reasonably be thought to be controlled when we're down below about 15,000 new cases a day. So we are exceeding that right now by a factor of 10, and it's going to get worse.
Yeah. And the vaccination rate nationwide is hovering at about 59%, which is nowhere near herd immunity. It's nowhere near the point where cases levels can start dropping again. Here in the state of Washington and along the West Coast, vaccination rates are above 80% in a lot of the, particularly Western Washington and a lot of the counties along the coast. And we're the only place in the United States that is seeing case levels dropping. So yeah. Although, still so many people out there who need to get the shot that's really what we need to concentrate
dropping,
on.
But the herd immunity with the Delta variant doesn't really kick in until you get to at least 90%.
So you get 90%.
And if Omicron is even more contagious, that means the herd immunity threshold will be increased that much more.
Yeah, I think another thing to be worried about, too, is that even though children under 11 have been able to get vaccinated, it's still a very, very low number that have received the pediatric dose, the pediatric vaccine. And I think that needs to increase as well if we want to make sure we don't have wide community spread of COVID-19. So parents need to step up.
Yep.
And meanwhile, the U.S., along with the other Western countries, continue to hoard the friggin' vaccine.
One of the reasons why Botswana, which is a kind of unlikely place for a major variant to emerge, right? It's a relatively sparsely populated country, about 2 million people. It's about the size of Texas. It's mostly desert. So you think of, you know, viruses thriving in jungle conditions or something. This is not that. But Botswana ordered about 500,000 Moderna doses of vaccine to give to its population of, you know, 2 million people last August. They still have not received them. Meanwhile, Moderna had charged them nearly $29 a dose, which is far higher than wealthier countries are paying. So vaccine inequity is real. And, you know, when poorer countries
I think the vaccination rate in South Africa is about 35%. So vaccine inequities are real. The hurdles are high for developing nations, and the developed world needs to do more to make sure that people in developing nations get access to vaccines and to help those countries administer the vaccines.
Yeah. So Omicron is a really good case study of why wealthy countries need to step up and make sure that the vaccine gets distributed worldwide, because it is a threat to everybody worldwide. And we're seeing that now with Omicron. you know, you get a major new variant, and this is something that experts have been predicting for months would probably emerge at some point, and now it has, apparently. You know, if you've got major pools of people in different parts of the world that are unvaccinated, and sub-Saharan Africa has nearly 1 billion people, and those people do not live in the Stone Age. They travel, they get on jets, they go to different parts of the world. You know, they spread the disease. So this is why, it is of such a concern. The United States announced yesterday, late in the day, after saying it would wait and see, it waited about 3 hours before announcing that, it was suspending flights from, 8 countries in Southern Africa. And it's really only that, that one flight from Johannesburg goes to New York that is a direct flight. But, you know, that's a daily flight. So it is already in this country. It's too, it's, you know, shutting the barn door after the horses have gone, and are galloping out in the field. And you know, you don't know what to do about it, so you shut the barn door. That's what this is. And it's not adequate at all. The United States needs to be, doing more, as other countries do as well. The Biden administration, to its credit, has done quite a bit so far to try and get vaccines distributed, and has donated quite a few vaccine doses. But really, when you have global distribution that is left in charge of big pharma, this is what happens, because the profit motive is more important than stopping a pandemic. And unfortunately, we're seeing that play out in real time right now.
Yeah, the the worship of intellectual property rights trumps saving people's lives. It's really what it comes.
Yeah, out. And. You know, there have been a lot of calls in the last 24 hours to suspend the intellectual property laws that are protecting the vaccines so they can be manufactured in different parts of the country. Because it's not that hard to manufacture
parts
if you
of the
know
world.
How to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interestingly, this is kind of a side note, but we got new data this week showing that Cuba's homemade vaccine, which they've been using to vaccine kids as well as adults, is just about as effective as Pfizer or Moderna. It's called Solarana 2. And, you know, the reason that Cuba developed its own vaccine is the U.S. embargo. They knew they couldn't get vaccine that was manufactured in the U.S. Yes, that embargo is still a thing after 60
Cuba,
years.
Yeah, Cuba has a long history of doing that, of developing their own vaccines and their own medical treatments because of lack of access to the Western world's products because of the U.S. embargo.
Yeah, and that embargo was lifted late in the Obama administration and then promptly reinstated by Trump. And so far as I'm aware, the Biden administration
has
kept
it
in place. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's our uplifting pandemic update for this week.
Yeah.
I expect it'll be worse next week.
Well, we'll see.
All right. Well, we are out of time.
Yeah. Well, that leaves us like 30 seconds to talk about the Arbery verdict. And I just want to remind people that that never would have gone to trial in the first place if it had been left in the hands of local authorities. That it was only when a video of the incident that was taken by one of the perpetrators was leaked by the defense attorney. Because he somehow thought that it would exonerate them, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation stepped in and the defendants, 23 guilty counts, for the three defendants, and they are still facing federal charges as well. And that's probably going to happen early next year, that trial.
All right. Well,
I want to put a good word for the Charlottesville verdict also. That was good news.
Okay. Talk to you both same time next week.
We'll be here.
Sounds good.